no nutritional function in our bodies except to float around producing free radicals that can damage tissue. Good quality animal fats contain vitamins A, D, B6, and B12, and some essential minerals. Free-range meat and eggs have a healthy rather than unhealthy cholesterol content because of what the animal ate during its happy little life. Chicken Recuerdos de Tucson is a chicken recipe we invented that reminds us of Tucson. You can also find it on our website. We use free-range chicken and fresh vegetables in summer, but in early spring we rely on our frozen zucchini and corn from last summer. The one essential fresh ingredient, cilantro, begins to show up in early farmers' markets. If you don't like cilantro, leave it out, of course, but the dish will lose its southwestern flavor.
Chapter 7. Gratitude. May. On Mother's Day, in keeping with local tradition, we gave out tomato plants. Elsewhere, this may be the genteel fete of hothouse orchids, but here the holiday's most important botanical connection is with tomatoes. Killing spring frosts may safely be presumed behind us, and it's time to get those plants into the garden. We grow ours from seed, so it's not just the nursery standard big boys for us. We raise more than a dozen different heirloom varieties. For our next-door neighbor, we picked out a narrow-leaved early bearer from the former Soviet Union with the romantic name of Silvery Fir Tree. Carrying the leggy, green-smelling plant, our family walked down the gravel driveway to her house at the bottom of our hollow. "Oh, well, goodness," she said, taking the plant from us and admiring it. "Well, look at that." Every region has its own language. In ours, it's a strict rule that you never say thank you for a plant. I don't know why. I was corrected many times on this point, even scolded earnestly before I learned. People have shushed me as I started to utter the words. They put their hands over their ears. "Why can't I say thank you?" I've asked. It's hard. Southern manners are so thoroughly bred into my brain. Accepting a gift without a thank you feels like walking away from changing a tire without washing my hands. "Just don't," people insist. If you do say it, they vow, the plant will wither up straight away and die. They have lots of stories to back this up. They do not wish to discuss whether plants have ears or what. Just don't. So we knew what our neighbor was trying not to say. We refrained from saying, "You're welcome," had a nice Sunday afternoon visit, and managed not to jinx this plant. It grew well. Of all the tomato plants that ultimately thrived in her garden, she told us the Silvery Fir Tree was the first to bear. On the week of May 9th, we set out our own tomatoes, 14 varieties in all. First, for early yields, Silvery Fir Tree, and Siberian Early, two Russian types that get down to work with proletarian resolve, bred as they were for short summers. For a more languid work ethic but juicy mid-season flavor, we grow Brandywines, Cherokee Purples, Orange Jaune Flamme, and Green Zebra, which is lemony and bright green striped when fully ripe. For spaghetti sauces and canning, Martino's Roma. Principi Borghese is an Italian bred specifically for sun-drying. Everything we grow has its reason, usually practical, but sometimes eccentric, like the Dolly Partons given us by an elderly seed-saving friend. "What do the tomatoes look like?" I asked. She cupped her hands around two enormous imaginary orbs and mugged, "Do you have to ask?" Most unusual, probably, is an old variety called Long Keeper. The fruits never fully ripen on the vine, but when harvested and wrapped in newspaper before frost, they slowly ripen by December. That's just the tomatoes. Also in the second week of May, we set out pepper seedlings and direct-seeded the corn, edamame, beets, and okra. Squash and cucumber plants went into hills under long tents of row-cover fabric to protect them from cool nights. We weeded the onions, pea vines, and potatoes. We planted seeds of chard, bush beans, and sunflowers, made bamboo teepees for the pole beans, and weathered some spring thunderstorms. That's one good week in food-growing country. By mid-month, once warmth was assured, we and all our neighbors set out our sweet potato vines. There was a small melee down at the Southern States Co-op when the management under-ordered sweet potato sets. We also put out winter squash, pumpkins, basil seedlings, eggplants, and melons, including cantaloupes, honeydews, rock melons, perfume melons, and four kinds of watermelons. Right behind planting come the weeding, mulching, vigilance for bugs and birds, worry over too much rain or not enough. It so resembles the never-ending work and attention of parenting, it seems right that it all should begin on Mother's Day. For people who grow food, late spring is the time when we pay for the relative quiet of January, praying for enough hours of daylight to get everything done. Many who farm for a living also have 9-to-5 jobs off the farm and still get it done. In May, we push deadlines, crunch our other work, borrow time, and still end up parking the tractor with its headlamp beams pointed down the row to finish getting the last plants healed into place. All through May, we worked in rain or under threat of it, playing chicken with lightning storms. We worked in mud so thick it made our boots as heavy as elephant feet. On work and school days, we started pre-dawn to get an early hour in, then in the late afternoon picked up again where we'd left off. On weekends, we started at daybreak and finished after dusk, aching and hungry from the work of making food. Labors like this help a person appreciate why good food costs what it does. It ought to cost more. In the midst of our busy spring, one of us had a birthday. Not just a run-of-the-mill birthday I could happily ignore, but an imposing one, involving an even fraction of 100. We cooked up a party plan, setting the date for Memorial Day so out-of-town guests could stay for the long weekend. We sent invitations and set about preparing for a throng of guests whom we would certainly want to feed. Our normal impulse would have been to stock up on standard-issue jet-propelled edibles, but we were deep enough into our local food sabbatical by now. That didn't seem entirely normal. Something had changed for us, a rearrangement of mindset and the contents of our refrigerator. Our family had certainly had our moments of longing for the illicit, shrimp, fresh peaches, and gummy worms, respectively. Our convictions about this project had been mostly theoretical to begin with. But gradually they were becoming fixed tastes that we now found we couldn't comfortably violate for our guests, any more than a Hindu might order up fast food burgers just because she had a crowd to feed. It put us in a bit of a pickle, though, to contemplate feeding a huge crowd on the products of our county this month. If my mother had borne me in some harvest festival month like October, it would have been easy. But she, like most sensible mammals, come to think of it, had all her children in the springtime, a fact I'd never minded until now. Feeding just my own household on the slim pickings of our local farms had been a challenge in April. The scene was perking up in May, but only slightly. Our spring had been unusually wet and cool, so the late spring crops were slow coming in. We called a friend who cooks for a living, who came over to discuss the game plan. Apparently, the customary starting point for caterers in a place that lacks its own food culture is for the client to choose a food theme that is somebody else's land-based food culture. Then all you have to do is import the ingredients from somebody else's land. Mediterranean? A banquet of tomato basil mozzarella salads, eggplant caponata, and butternut ravioli? That's a crowd pleaser. And out of the question. No tomatoes or eggplants yet existed in our landscape. Our earliest of early tomatoes was now at the blossom stage. Mexican? Enchiladas and chipotle rice? Great, except no peppers or tomatillos were going to shine around here. Siberian tundra was maybe the cuisine we were after. We began to grow glum, thinking of borscht. Not to worry, said Kay. A good food artist knows her sources. She would call the farmers she knew and see what they had. Starting with ingredients, we'd build our menu from there. As unusual as this might seem, it is surely the world's most normal way of organizing parties. The grape revels of Italy and France in September, the Appalachian ramp hoedowns in April, harvest festivals wherever and whenever a growing season ends. That's why Canadian Thanksgiving comes 6 weeks before ours. So does Canadian winter. We were determined to have a feast, but if we meant to ignore the land's timetable of generosity and organize it instead around the likes of birthdays, a good travel weekend, and the schedules of our musician friends, that was our problem. Kay called back with a report on our county's late May pantry. There would be asparagus, of course, plus lots of baby lettuces and spinach by then. Free-range eggs are available here year-round. Our friend Kirsty had free-range chicken, and the Klings, just a few miles from us, had grass-fed lamb. The Petersons had strawberries. Charlie had rhubarb. Another family was making goat cheese. White's Mill, 5 miles from our house, had flour. If we couldn't pull together a feast out of that, I wasn't worth the Betty Crocker Homemaker of Tomorrow Award I won in 1972. Kind of by accident, but that's another story. The menu wrote itself. Lamb kebabs on the grill, chicken pizza with goat cheese, asparagus frittata, an enormous salad of spring greens, and a strawberry rhubarb crisp. To fill out the menu for vegan friends, we added summer rolls with bean sprouts, carrots, green onions, and a spicy dipping sauce. We had carrots in the garden I had nursed over the winter for an extra early crop, and Camille ordinarily grew bean sprouts by the quart in our kitchen windowsill. She would ramp up her production to a couple of gallons. We might feed our multitudes after all. As the RSVPs rolled in, we called farmers to plead for more strawberries, more chickens. They kindly obliged. The week of the party, I cut from our garden the first 3 giant heads of early comet broccoli, plants we'd started indoors in February and set out into nearly frozen soil in March. Without knowing it, I'd begun preparing for this party months ago. I liked seeing now how that whole process, beginning with seeds, ending with dinner, fixed me to some deeper-than-usual sense of hospitality. Anyone who knows the pleasure of cooking elaborately for loved ones understands this. Genesis and connection with annual cycles. By means of these, a birthday could be more than a slap on the back and jokes about memory loss. On Tuesday, 4 days pre-party, Camille and I hoed weeds from around corn seedlings and planted 10 hills of melons for some distant future party. Maybe we'd have corn and cantaloupe by Lily's birthday in July. By dusk, the wind was biting our ears, and the temperature was falling fast. We hoped the weather would turn kinder by this weekend. We expected well over 100 people, about 30 spending the weekend. Rain would wreck any chance for outdoor dancing, and camping in the yard would be grim. We scowled at the clouds, remembering, ruefully, the cashier who'd jinxed the rain in Tucson. We weren't in drought here, so we decided we could hope with impunity, and then take what came. On Wednesday, we checked the bean sprouts Camille had started in 2 glass-gallon jars. Their progress was unimpressive. If they intended to fill out 100 fat, translucent summer rolls in 3 days, they had some work to do. We tried putting them in a sunnier window, but the day was cloudy. Suddenly inspired, we plugged in a heating pad and wrapped it around the jars. Just an hour did the trick. I'm sure we violated some principle of deep ecology, but with just a quick jolt from the electric grid, our sprouts were on their way, splitting open their seeds and pushing fat green tails into the world. On Thursday, I went to the garden for carrots, hoping for enough. With carrots, you never know what you've got until you grab them by the green hair and tug them up. These turned out to be gorgeous, golden orange, thicker than thumbs, longer than my hand. Shaved into slivers with green onions and our indolent sprouts, 2 dozen carrots would be plenty. I could only hope the lambs and chickens were cooperating as well. I stood for a minute clutching my carrots, looking out over our pasture to Walker Mountain on the horizon. The view from our garden is spectacular. I thought about people I knew who right at that moment might be plucking chickens, picking strawberries and lettuce, just for us. I felt grateful to the people involved, and the animals also. I don't say this facetiously. I sent my thanks across the county, like any sensible person saying grace before a meal. Guests began to trickle in on Friday. Extended family from Kentucky, old college friends from South Carolina, our musician friends John, Carrie, and Robert. I was bowled over by the simultaneous presence of so many people I care about, from as far away as Tucson and as near as next door. We made all the beds and couches and pitched tents. We walked in the garden and visited. All those under age 12 welded into a pack and ran around like wild things. I overheard a small platoon leader in the garden command, "You, whatever your name is, go down that way and I'll hide and we'll scare the girls." I only made two rules: don't injure each other and don't flatten the crops. With the exception of one scraped finger and the tiniest mishap with the Dolly Parton, they obliged. We set up a sound system on the back patio, dragged bales of straw into benches, and eyed the sky, which threatened rain all day Saturday, but by late afternoon had not delivered. We carried a horse trough out of the barn and filled it with ice to chill our Virginia Chambersin and Misty River wines and beer from a nearby microbrewery. The lamb kebabs on the grill made all our mouths water for an hour while Kay and her helpers worked their mojo in our kitchen. The food, when it came out, was applauded. The summer rolls were saucy, the lamb succulent, the frittata puffy and light. The strawberry rhubarb crisp vanished into thin air. Here's what we didn't have. The shrimp arranged in a ring like pink poker chips. Those rock-hard broccoli wedges and lathed carrots surrounding the ubiquitous white dip. The pile of pineapple and melon chunks on a platter. Nobody seemed too disappointed. Some of us were, in fact, sticking our fingers into the rhubarb crisp pans to lick up crumbs when the music started. The three-year-olds were the first ones out on the flagstone dance floor, of course, followed closely by my 75-year-old parents, the teenagers, and the elders, and the middle-aged, recklessly dancing across age categories. And it still didn't rain. Nobody fell in the creek, nobody went hungry, and nobody's husband refused to dance. When the night chilled us, we built a huge bonfire, and nobody fell into that either. Midnight found me belting out backup harmonies with my cousin Linda to "You Can't Always Get What You Want" by the Rolling Stones. The over-50 crowd stayed on its feet until 2 in the morning. You get what you need. I'd asked for no presents. The stuff acquisition curve of my life has long since peaked and lately turned into a campaign against accumulation with everyday skirmishes on the kitchen table. Not just mail and school papers, either. I mean stuff on that table. Shoes, auto parts, live arthropods in small wire cages. No presents, I said. Really. But here in Dixie, we will no more show up to a party empty-handed than bare-bottomed, because that's how we were raised. A covered dish is standard, but was unnecessary in this case. To make everyone comfortable, we had to suggest an alternative. Camille made the call, and it was inspired. A plant. The tiniest posy, anything would serve. And truthfully, while we'd put prodigious efforts into our vegetable garden and orchards, our front yard lay sorry and neglected. Anything people might bring to set into that ground would improve it. Thus began the plan for my half-century birthday garden, higgledy-piggledy, fluorescent and spontaneous, like friendship itself. This is what my friends brought. Dug from their own backyards, a division of a 50-year-old peony, irises, a wisteria vine, spicy sweet shrub, bee balm, hostas, datura, lilies, and a flowering vine whose name none of us knows. My parents brought an aristocrat pear, a variety bred by an old friend from our hometown. A geographer friend brought Portuguese collards. Another indulged my fondness for red-hot chili peppers. Rosemary and sage, blueberry and raspberry, fountain grass, blue sweet grass, sunshine-colored roses, blue and white columbines, scarlet poppies, butterfly bush, and sunset echinacea. The color scheme of my garden is Crayola. Our neighbor, to whom we'd taken the tomato plant, dug some divisions of her prettiest lemon lilies. "Oh, well, goodness," I said as I received each of these botanical gifts. "Well, look at that." I thanked my parents for having me, thanked the farmers for the food, thanked family and friends for the music, the dancing, the miles traveled, and the stunning good luck of having them all in my life. But I did not say thank you for a plant. My garden lives.
Happy Returns by Camille. Birthdays have always been a big deal in my family. Mom would cook exactly what we wanted for dinner and bake any kind of cake for Lily and me on our special days. Our only limit was the one-year, one-person rule. Each year, I could invite as many people to my party as the age I was turning. So, 3 kids at my 3-year-old party, 10 at my 10th. As you can probably guess, things got increasingly wild. At one point, I remember asking, "Mama, when I turn 30, can I really have 30 people at my party?" I was shocked when she said, "Sure, absolutely." Wow, I thought, excited already at the thought of that huge celebration. Now I just think it's funny that I assumed I'd still be living with my parents on my 30th birthday. Last spring, when my mom turned 50, she broke her own rule big time. None of us minded. What could be better than a long weekend of live music, good food, and friends and family from all over? We spent weeks setting up for the 150 guests and trying to come up with a perfect plan B, which we never really did, if it rained. I was inspired to see so many people in the 50-plus age group up and dancing well past midnight, grandparents included. I hope I'll still be dancing and breaking my own rules when I'm that age. 2 of our friend Kay's best recipes from the party are good ways to feature the early spring vegetables and the only fruits you're likely to find in May, strawberries and rhubarb. See the website for Asian vegetable rolls and strawberry rhubarb crisp. Here is our early spring meal plan. Sunday, grilled chicken, fresh bread, and a giant salad of fresh greens, carrots, and peas. Monday, asparagus and morel bread pudding. Tuesday, Asian summer rolls with spicy peanut sauce served with rice. Wednesday, vegetarian tacos with refried beans, pea shoots, lettuce, spring onions, and cheese. Thursday, cheese ravioli tossed with stir-fried spring vegetables, oregano, and olive oil. Friday, chicken pizza with olives and feta. Saturday, frittata packed with cheese and vegetables, salad, strawberry rhubarb crisp.
Chapter 8. Growing Trust. Mid-June. Twice a year, on opposite points around the calendar's circle, the perpetual motion of our garden life goes quiet. One is obvious, midwinter, when fields lie under snow. Our animals need extra care then, but any notion of tomato is history. The other vegetal lull is in June, around Midsummer's Day. Seeds are in the ground if they're going to be. Corn and beans are up. Cukes and tomatoes are blossoming. Broccoli and asparagus are harvested. Peas are winding down. It isn't that we walk out into the field on June 10th and say, "Wow, nothing to do anymore." There will always be more weeds. Everything could be mulched better, fed more compost, protected better against groundhogs. A thriving field of vegetables is as needy as a child. And similarly, the custodian's job isn't done till the goods have matured and moved out. But you can briefly tiptoe away from the sleeping baby. It's going to wake up wailing, but if you need the rest, you get while the getting is good. We had planned our escape for late June, the one time between May planting and September harvest when it seemed feasible to take a short vacation from our farm. If we'd been marketing to customers or retailers, this would still be a breakneck time of getting orders lined up and successive plantings laid out. Our farming friends all agree this is the most trying challenge of the job, lost mobility. It's nearly impossible to leave fields and animals for just one day, let alone a week. Even raising food on our relatively modest scale required that we put in overtime to buy a respite. We mulched everything heavily to keep root systems moist, discourage weeds, and prevent late blight. My favorite mulching method is to cover the ground between rows of plants with a year's worth of our saved newspapers. The paper and soy-based ink will decompose by autumn. Then we cover all that newsprint, comics, axe murderers, presidents, and all, with a deep layer of old straw. It is grand to walk down the rows, dumping armloads of moldy grass glop onto the faces of your less favorite heads of state. A year in review, already starting to compost. Believe it or not, weeds will still come up through all this, but it takes a while. With neighbors on call to refill the poultry waterers, open and close coops, and keep an eye on the green things, we figured on escaping for a week and a half. Our plan was to head north in a big loop through New England, up to Montreal, and back through Ohio, staying with friends and relatives all along the way. We nearly had the car packed when it started raining cherries. We had been watching our huge cherry trees, which every June bear fruit enough to eat and freeze for pies and sorbets all year long. This, plus our own sparse peaches, plums, Asian pears, and a local orchard's autumn apples, were the only local sources of tree fruits we knew about, and we didn't want to miss any of them. Our diet had turned our attention keenly to fruit above all else. Like the Frostburg man with his 83 mealy peaches and so forth, we wanted our USDA requirement. This winter, we'd be looking at applesauce and whatever other frozen fruit we could put by ahead of time, at whatever moment it came into season. Tree-ripened fruit, for the local gourmand, is definitely worth scheduling your vacation around. Last year, my journal said, the cherries had ripened around June 8th. This year, summer was off to such a cool, slow start. We stood under the tree and tried to generate heat with our heart's desire. Then it happened. On June 15th, one day before our planned departure, the hard red spheres turned to glossy black all at once. The birds showed up in noisy gangs, and up we went to join them. Standing on ladders and the roof of the truck, we picked all afternoon into dusk, till we were finding the fruits with our fingers instead of our eyes. Like the narrator of Kazantzaki's Zorba the Greek, I have a resolute weakness for cherries. Annually, I take Zorba's advice on the cure. So far, it hasn't worked. All of us were smitten, filling gallon buckets, biting cherries alive from their stems. This was our first taste of firm, sweet fruit flesh in months, since the early April day when we'd taken our vows and forsworn all exotics. Fruit is what we'd been hankering for, the only deprivation that kept needling us. Now we ate our fill, delivered some to neighbors, and put 2 gallons in the freezer, rejoicing. Our fructose celibacy was over. The next day, our hands were still stained red as Lady Macbeth's, but it was time to go, or we'd never get our trip. We packed up some gifts for the many friends whose hospitality and guest beds lay ahead of us. Cherries, of course, bottles of local wine, and a precious few early tomatoes we had managed to pamper to ripeness by June 12th, a record for our neighborhood. We threw bags of our salad greens and snap peas into a cooler with some cheese and homemade bread for munching along the way. If we waited around, some other task would start to fall on our heads. We could practically hear the weeds clawing at the president's face. We hit the gas and sped away. Farming is not for everybody. Increasingly, it's hardly for anybody. Over the last decade, our country has lost an average of 300 farms a week. Large or small, each of those was the life's work of a real person or family. People who built their lives around a promise and watched it break. The loss of a farm is a darkness leading to some of life's bitterest ends. Keeping one, on the other hand, may mean also working in a factory at the end of a long daily drive, behind and ahead of the everyday work of farming. Wherever farms are still living, it's due to some combination of luck, courage, and adaptability. In my home state, Kentucky, our agriculture is known for two non-edible commodities, tobacco and racehorses. The latter is a highly capitalized industry that spreads little of its wealth into the small family farm. The former was the small farm's bottom dollar until the bottom dropped out. In my lifetime, Kentucky farmers have mostly had the options of going broke or going six ways to Sunday for the sake of staying solvent. I know former tobacco growers who now raise certified organic gourmet mushrooms, bison steaks, or asparagus and fancy salad greens for restaurants. On the bluegrass that famously nourished Manowar and Secretariat, more modest enterprises with names like Hard Times Farm and Mother Hubbard's are now raising pasture-fed beef, pork, lamb, and turkeys. Kentucky farms produce flowers, garlic, organic berries and vegetables, emu and ostrich products, catfish and rainbow trout. Right off the Paris Pike, a country lane I drove 100 times in my teenage years, a farmer named Sue now grows freshwater shrimp. If we could have imagined this when I was in high school, that our county's fields might someday harbor prawn ponds and shiitakes, I suppose we would have laughed our heads off. The first time I went to a party where Kentucky caviar was served, I suspected a trick, as in Rocky Mountain oyster. It wasn't. It was Louisville-grown fish eggs. Innovative cottage industries are life and death for these farmlands. Small pioneering agricultural ventures are the scene of more hard work, risk-taking, and creative management than most people imagine. Among other obstacles, these farmers have to contend with a national press that is quick to pronounce them dead. Diversified food-producing farms on the outskirts of cities are actually the fastest-growing sector of U.S. agriculture. The small farm is at the moment very busy thinking its way out of a box, working like mad to protect the goodness and food security of a largely ungrateful nation. These producers can't survive by catering only to the upscale market, either. The majority of farmers market customers are people of ordinary means, and low-income households are not necessarily excluded. An urban area in eastern Tennessee has a vegetable equivalent of a bookmobile, allowing regional farmers to get produce into neighborhoods whose only other food purchasing option might be a liquor store. Though many eligible mothers may not know it, the U.S. Nutritional Assistance Program for Women with Infants and Children, or WIC, gives coupons redeemable at farmers markets to more than 2.5 million participants in 44 states. Likewise, the Senior Farmers Market Nutrition Program awards grants to 40 states and numerous Indian tribal governments to help low-income seniors buy locally grown fruits, vegetables, and herbs. Citizen-led programs from California to New York are linking small farmers with school lunch programs and food banks. Even so, a perception of organic food as an elite privilege is a considerable obstacle to the farmer growing food for middle-income customers whose highest food shopping priority is the lowest price. Raising food without polluting the field or the product will always cost more than the conventional mode that externalizes costs to taxpayers and the future. To farm sustainably and also stay in business, these market gardeners have to bridge the psychological gap between what consumers could pay and what we will actually shell out. Grocery money is an odd sticking point for U.S. citizens who, on average, spend a lower proportion of our income on food than people in any other country or any heretofore in history. In our daily fare, even in school lunches, we broadly justify consumption of tallow-fried animal pulp on the grounds that it's cheaper than whole grains, fresh vegetables, hormone-free dairy, and such. Whether on school boards or in families, budget keepers may be aware of the health trade-off, but still feel compelled to economize on food in a manner that would be utterly unacceptable if the health risk involved an unsafe family vehicle or a plume of benzene running through a school basement. It's interesting that penny pinching is an accepted defense for toxic food habits when frugality so rarely rules other consumer domains. The majority of Americans buy bottled drinking water, for example, even though water runs from the faucets at home for a fraction of the cost, and government quality standards are stricter for tap water than for bottled. At any income level, we can be relied upon for categorically unnecessary purchases. Portable earplug music instead of the radio, extra-fast internet for leisure use, heavy vehicles to transport light loads, name-brand clothing instead of plainer gear. Economizing, as applied to clothing, generally means looking for discount name brands instead of wearing last year's clothes again. The dread of rearing unfashionable children is understandable, but as a priority, makes me look cool has passed up keeps arteries functional and left the kids huffing and puffing fashionably in the dust. Nobody should need science to prove the obvious, but plenty of studies do show that regularly eating cheaply produced fast food and processed snack foods slaps on extra pounds that increase the risks of diabetes, cardiovascular harm, joint problems, and many cancers. As a country, we're officially over the top. The majority of our food dollars buy those cheap calories, and most of our citizens are medically compromised by weight and inactivity. The incidence of obesity-associated diabetes has more than doubled since 1990, with children the fastest-growing class of victims. The name had to be changed from adult onset to type 2 diabetes. One out of every $3 we spend on health care, by some recent estimates, is paying for the damage of bad eating habits. One out of every 7 specifically pays to assuage, but not cure, the multiple heartbreaks of diabetes, kidney failure, strokes, blindness, amputated limbs. An embarrassing but arguable point is that we're applying deadly priorities to our food budgets because we believe the commercials. Industrial agriculture can promote its products on a supersized scale. 80% of the beef packing industry is controlled by 4 companies. The consolidation is exactly the same for soybean processing. With such vast corporate budgets weighing in on the side of beef and added fats, it's no surprise that billions of dollars a year go into advertising fast food. The surprise is how handsomely marketers recoup that investment, how successfully they convince us that cheap food will make us happy. How delusional are we exactly? Insisting to farmers that our food has to be cheap is like commanding a 10-year-old to choose a profession and move out of the house now. It violates the spirit of the enterprise. It guarantees bad results. The economy of the arrangement will come around to haunt you. Anyone with a working knowledge of children would see the flaw in that parenting strategy. Similarly, it takes a farmer to understand the analogous truth about food production, that time and care yield quality that matters, and explain that to the rest of us. Industry will not, but individual market growers can communicate concern that they're growing food in a way that's healthy and safe for people and a place. They can educate consumers about a supply chain that's as healthy or unhealthy as we choose to make it. That information doesn't fit in a 5-syllable jingle. And those growers will never win a price war either. The best they can hope for is a marketing tactic known as friendship or something like it. Their task is to communicate the consumer value of their care and how it benefits the neighborhood. This may seem like a losing battle, but the Buy Cheap Eats crusade is assisting the deaths of our compatriots at the rate of about 820 a day. Somebody's bound to notice that. We are a social animal. The cost-benefit ratios of neighborliness are as old as our species and probably inescapable in the end.
Paying the Price of Low Prices by Stephen Hoff. A common complaint about organic and local foods is that they're more expensive than conventional or industrially grown foods. Most consumers don't realize how much we're already paying for the conventional foods before we even get to the supermarket. Our tax dollars subsidize the petroleum used in growing, processing, and shipping these products. We also pay direct subsidies to the large-scale chemical-dependent brand of farming, and we're being forced to pay more each year for the environmental and health costs of that method of food production. Here's an exercise. Add up the portion of agricultural fuel use that is paid for with our taxes, $22 billion, direct farm bill subsidies for corn and wheat, $3 billion, treatment of food-related illnesses, $10 billion, agricultural chemical cleanup costs, $17 billion, collateral costs of pesticide use, $8 billion, and costs of nutrients lost to erosion, $20 billion. At a minimum, that's a national subsidy of at least $80 billion, about $725 per household each year. That, plus the sticker price, buys our inexpensive conventional food. Organic practices build rather than deplete the soil, using manure and cover crops. They eliminate pesticides and herbicides, instead using biological pest controls and some old-fashioned weeding with a hoe. They maintain and apply knowledge of many different crops. All this requires extra time and labor. Smaller farms also bear relatively higher costs for packaging, marketing, and distribution. But the main difference is that organic growers aren't forcing us to pay expenses they've shifted into other domains, such as environmental and health damage. As they're allowed to play a larger role in the U.S. agricultural economy, our subsidy costs to industrial agriculture will decrease. For a few dollars up front, it's a blue chip investment.
Ashfield, Massachusetts is as cute as it gets, even by the standards of small town New England. Downtown is anchored by a hardware store with rocking chairs on the front porch. The big local social event where folks catch up with their neighbors is the weekly farmers market. I didn't know this when we arrived there to stay at a friend's house. We brought in our cooler with the luggage, planning to give our hostess some of our little fist-sized tomatoes. These carefully June-ripened treasures would wow the New Englanders, I thought. Whoops! As I started to pull them out of the cooler, I spied half a dozen huge red tomatoes languidly sunning their shapely shoulders in our friend's kitchen window. These bodacious babes made our early Siberians look like Miss Congeniality. I pulled out some blackheart cherries instead, presenting them along with an offhand question. So where did those tomatoes come from? Oh, from Amy at the farmer's market, she said. Aren't they nice? Nice, I thought. In the third week of June, in Western Mass, if they taste as good as they look, they're a doggone miracle. I was extremely curious. Our host promised that during our visit, she would take us to see Amy, the tomato magician. On the appointed morning, we took a narrow road that led from Ashfield up through wooded hills to a farm where Amy grows vegetables and her partner Paul works as a consultant in the design and construction of innovative housing. Their own house is pretty much the definition of innovative, a little round mushroom-shaped structure whose sod and moss roof was covered in a summer pelt of jewel weeds. It was the kind of setting that leads you to expect an elf, maybe, but Paul and Amy stepped out instead. They invited us up to the roof, where we could sit on a little bench. Ulan the dog followed us up the ladder stairs and sat panting happily as we took in the view of the creek valley below. Part of Paul's work in dynamic housing design is to encourage people to think more broadly about both construction materials— walls of stacked straw bales are his specialty, and how to use space creatively, such as Dog on the Roof. I couldn't wait to see the gardens. First, though, we had to eat the breakfast they'd made in their tiny, efficient kitchen. Everything locally produced, yogurt and strawberries, eggs, salsa made with Amy's enviable tomatoes. We lingered, talking farming and housing, but the day called us out to the fields, where rows of produce were already gulping morning sun. Amy, a self-described perfectionist, apologized for the state of what looked to me like the tidiest rows imaginable, more weedless than our garden on the best of days. Part-time interns sometimes help out, but the farm runs on Amy's full-time dedication. A mid-June New England garden, 2 weeks past the last frost, is predominantly green. Lacy bouquets of salad greens, Chinese cabbage, cilantro, broccoli, and peas. A tomato of any type seemed out of the question until we crested a hill and came upon two long greenhouses. These are the sturdy workhorses of the farm, with heavy-duty plastic skins supported by wooden trusses. Amy no longer grows tomatoes anywhere except in a greenhouse. Cool spring soil, late frosts, and iffy New England weather make the season too short for noteworthy harvests of outdoor-planted tomatoes. But she doesn't grow them hydroponically, as is the norm for large-scale tomato houses. Her greenhouses are built over garden soil. Her tomatoes grow in the ground. "They taste better," she said. "It's probably the micronutrients and microfauna in the soil that give them that garden taste. So many components of soil just aren't present in a more sterile environment." Heating greenhouses through the Massachusetts winter didn't appeal to Paul and Amy either. After a few years of experiments, they found it most cost-effective to heat with a combination of propane and wood stoves, or not at all. One of the houses is exclusively a cold frame, extending the season for salad greens, spinach, and other crops that can take temperatures down to the mid-20s. Amy's greens will sell all winter for about $7 a pound. In New York City, midwinter mescaline can bring $20. Her second greenhouse is heated, she said, but only in spring. As we approached that one, I peered in the door and actually gasped. Holy tomato! I've never seen healthier, more content-looking plants, 10 feet tall, leafy, rising toward heaven on strings stretched from the ground to the rafters. If there were an angel choir of tomatoes, these would be singing. The breed she grows is one meant especially for greenhouses, a variety, perfectly enough, called Trust. Amy was inspiring to watch, a knowledgeable farmer in her element as she narrowed her eyes for signs of pests, pausing to finger a leaf and study its color. We walked among the tall plants, admiring the clusters of fruits hanging from bottom to top in a color gradient from mature red fruits below to the new greenish-white ones overhead. The support strings were rolled around spindles up above that could be cranked to lower the plant down gradually as the top continues to climb. Tomato plants habitually lose their lower leaves as they grow. The point of this system is to coil the leafless stems on the ground and let the healthy growing part keep twining upward. But these plants were so healthy they refused to lose any lower leaves. Lily played hide-and-seek in the tomato wilderness while Amy showed me her growing system. She fine-tunes it a little more each year, but already her operation is an obvious success. The last time she had soil tests, the technicians who came to evaluate her compost-built organic dirt had never seen such high nutrient values. The greatest limitation here is temperature. She could keep tomatoes growing all winter, but the cost of fuel would pass her profit margin. In early spring, when she's starting the plants, she economizes by heating the soil under the seedlings. Wood stove heated water runs through underground pipes, while letting air temperatures drop fairly low. Pushing the season early is more important than late, she says. People will pay more for a June tomato than one in October, when tomatoes are old hat, dropping off the vines in gardens everywhere. By starting in the spring, she can bring bushels of trust out of her greenhouse to thrilled customers long before anything red is coming out of local gardens. I observed that in the first week of June, she could charge anything she wanted for these. She laughed. I could, but I don't. I belong to this community. People know me. I wouldn't want to take advantage. She is more than just part of the community. She was a co-founder of the hugely successful Ashfield Farmers Market. She sells to individuals and restaurants and enjoys a local diet by relying on other producers for the things she doesn't grow. We don't have chickens, for example, she said, because so many other people do. We trade vegetables for eggs and meat. Their favorite local restaurant buys Amy's produce all summer, the last 2 months for credit, so that in winter she and Paul can eat there whenever they want. He deems the arrangement a great substitute for canning. Like many small farms, this perfectly organic operation is not certified organic. Amy estimates certification would cost her $700 a year, and she wouldn't gain that much value from it. Virtually everyone who buys her food knows Amy personally. Many have visited the farm. They know she is committed to chemical-free farming because she values her health, her products, the safety of interns and customers, and the profoundly viable soil of her fields and greenhouses. Farmers like Amy generally agree that organic standards are a good thing on principle. When consumers purchase food at a distance from where it's grown, certification lets them know it was grown in conditions that are clearly codified and enforced. Farmers who sell directly to their customers, on the other hand, generally don't need watchdogs. Their livelihood tends to be a mission as well as a business. Amy's customers trust her methods. No federal bureaucracy can replace that relationship. Furthermore, the paper trail of organic standards offers only limited guarantees to the consumer. Specifically, it certifies that vegetables were grown without genetic engineering or broadly toxic chemical herbicides or pesticides. Animals were not given growth-promoting hormones or antibiotics. Certified organic does not necessarily mean sustainably grown, worker-friendly, fuel-efficient, cruelty-free, or any other virtue a consumer might wish for. The rising consumer interest in organic food has inspired most of the country's giant food conglomerates to cash in at some level. These big players have successfully moved the likes of bagged salads and hormone-free milk from boutique to mainstream markets and even big box stores. But low price has its costs. In order to meet federal organic standards as cheaply as possible and maximize profits, some industrial-scale organic producers, though not all, cut every corner that's allowed and are lobbying the government to loosen organic rules further. Some synthetic additives are now permitted, thanks to pressure from industrial organics. So is animal confinement. A chicken may be sold as free-range if the house in which it's confined with 20,000 others has a doorway leading out to a tiny yard, even though that doorway remains shut for so much of the chickens' lives they never learn to go outside. This is not a theoretical example. A national brand of organic dairy products also uses confined animals, in this case, cows whose mandated free-range time may find them at home in crowded pens without water, shade, or anything resembling the range. The larger the corporation, the more distant its motives are apt to be from the original spirit of organic farming, and the farther the products will likely be shipped to buyers who will smile at the happy farm picture on the package and never be the wiser. Because organic farming is labor-intensive, holding prices down has even led some large-scale organic growers into direct conflict with OSHA and the United Farm Workers. Just over half of U.S. farm workers are undocumented, and all are unlikely to earn more than minimum wage. Those employed by industrial-scale organic farms are spared direct contact with pesticides in their work, at least, but often live with their families in work camp towns where pesticide drift is as common as poverty. The original stated purpose of organic agriculture was not just to protect the quality of food products, but also to safeguard farm environments and communities through diversified, biologically natural practices that remain healthy over time. This was outlined by J.I. Rodale, Sir Albert Howard, Lady Eve Balfour, and all other significant contributors to the theory and practice of modern organic agriculture. Implicitly, these are values that many consumers still think they're supporting with their purchase of organic products. Increasingly, small-scale food farmers like Amy feel corporate organics may be betraying that confidence, extracting too much in the short term from their biotic and human communities, stealing the heart of a movement. The best and only defense for both growers and the consumers who care is a commitment to more local food economies. It may not be possible to prevent the corruption of codified organic standards when they are so broadly applied. A process as complex as sustainable agriculture can't be fully mandated or controlled. The government might as well try to legislate happy marriage. Corporate growers, if their only motive is profit, will find ways to follow the letter of organic regulations while violating their spirit. But locally grown is a denomination whose meaning is incorruptible. Sparing the transportation fuel, packaging, and unhealthy additives is a compelling part of the story, but the plot goes well beyond that. Local food is a handshake deal in a community gathering place. It involves farmers with first names who show up week after week. It means an open-door policy on the fields, where neighborhood buyers are welcome to come have a look and pick their own food from the vine. Local is farmers growing trust. Chapter 9. Six Impossible Things Before Breakfast. Late June. When I was in college, living two states away from my family, I studied the map one weekend and found a different route home from the one we usually traveled. I drove back to Kentucky the new way, which did turn out to be faster. During my visit, I made sure all my relatives heard about the navigational brilliance that saved me 37 minutes. 37, my grandfather mused. And here you just used up 15 of them telling all about it. What's your plan for the other 22? Good question. I'm still stumped for an answer whenever the religion of time-saving pushes me to zip through a meal or a chore, rushing everybody out the door to the next point on a schedule. All that hurry can blur the truth that life is a zero-sum equation. Every minute I save will get used on something else, possibly no more sublime than staring at the newel post trying to remember what I just ran upstairs for. On the other hand, attending to the task in front of me, even a quotidian chore, might make it into a part of a good day, rather than just a rock in the road to someplace else. I have a farmer friend who would definitely side with my grandfather on the subject of time's economies. He uses draft animals instead of a tractor. Doesn't it take an eternity to turn a whole field with a horse-driven plow? The answer, he says, is yes. Eternal is the right frame of mind. When I'm out there cultivating the corn, he says, with a good team in the quiet of the afternoon, watching the birds in the hedgerows, oh my goodness, I could just keep going all day. Kids from the city come out here and ask, what do you do for fun around here? I tell them, I cultivate. Now that I'm decades older and much less clever than I was in college, I'm getting better at facing life's routines the way my friend faces his cornfield. I haven't mastered the serene mindset on all household chores. What do you do for fun around here? I scrub pots and pans, okay? But I might be getting there with cooking. Eternal is the right frame of mind for making food for a family. Cooking down the tomatoes into a red gold oregano scented sauce for pasta. Before that, harvesting sun-ripened fruits, pinching oregano leaves from their stems, growing these things from seed. Yes, a lifetime is what I'm after. Cooking is definitely one of the things we do for fun around here. When I'm in a blue mood, I head for the kitchen. I turn the pages of my favorite cookbooks, summoning the prospective joyful noise of a shared meal. I stand over a bubbling soup, close my eyes, and inhale. From the ground up, everything about nourishment steadies my soul. Yes, I have other things to do. For 19 years, I've been nothing but a working mother, one of the legions who could justify a lot of packaged, pre-cooked foods if I wanted to feed those to my family. I have no argument with convenience on principle. I'm inordinately fond of my dishwasher, and I like the shiny tools that lie in my kitchen drawers, ready to make me a menace to any vegetable, living or dead. I know the art of the quickie supper for after a long day nights, and sometimes if we're too weary, we'll go out to a restaurant, mainly to keep the kitchen clean. But if I were to define my style of feeding my family on a permanent basis by the dictum, get it over with quick, something cherished in our family life would collapse. And I'm not just talking waistlines, though we'd miss those. I'm discussing dinner time, the cornerstone of our family's mental health. If I had to quantify it, I'd say 75% of my crucial parenting effort has taken place during or surrounding the time our family convenes for our evening meal. I'm sure I'm not the only parent to think so. A survey of National Merit Scholars, exceptionally successful 18-year-olds crossing all lines of ethnicity, gender, geography, and class, turned up a common thread in their lives, the habit of sitting down to a family dinner table. It's not just the food making them brilliant. It's probably the parents, their care, priorities, and culture of support. The words, "I'll expect you home for dinner." I understand that most U.S. citizens don't have room in their lives to grow food or even see it growing, but I have trouble accepting the next step in our journey toward obligate symbiosis with the packaged meal and takeout. Cooking is a dying art in our culture. Why is a good question and an uneasy one, because I find myself politically and socioeconomically entangled in the answer. I belong to the generation of women who took as our youthful rallying cry, "Allow us a good education so we won't have to slave in the kitchen." We recoiled from the proposition that keeping a husband presentable and fed should be our highest intellectual aspiration. We fought for